Welcome to the Living Life on Purpose podcast with your host, Michael Mukunda Chandra Cohan, the founder of YourWellnessYogi.com and the Living Life on Purpose community. The Living Life on Purpose podcast is a show dedicated to inspiring people to achieve their goals and live their dreams to the highest potential. Life is short. Learn to live it on purpose. Inside all of us is a powerful spark of the divine, and yet as life's challenges grind and wear us down, many of us forget that inner spark. However, that spark never leaves us, and if we stray too far from it, we will be unhappy in our life. At Your Wellness Yogi and the Living Life on Purpose community, we are dedicated to helping you discover that inner spark in life. We offer a variety of life coaching packages that meet your needs and budget. We have group coaching, monthly mindfulness mastermind calls, and one-to-one coaching. Get started today and take advantage of our two free personal one-to-one coaching conversations by taking the Circle of Life quiz, a free life assessment tool that helps you reveal the big picture of your true dreams and paves the road for real personalized action plan to take control of your life. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/life. Before we get started, I wanted to ask you a favor, to write us an honest review of our podcast. By writing us a review, you will help raise our profile so more people can find us on iTunes. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/podcast and click on subscribe to open up in iTunes and write us a review. You can also write us a review on your device as you listen to the show by opening up the podcast app. Thank you and enjoy this week's episode, and I appreciate you listening. Hey guys, thanks for listening to another episode of the Living Life on Purpose community. Today's full-length episode is with our guest, Dr. Rob. Dr. Rob is the president of the Academy of Jungian Spiritual Psychology, a personal development community that transforms people's lives through the trainings and multimedia online courses. Dr. Rob is recognized internationally as a human behavior and relationship expert. He earned his PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Wisconsin and an MA in clinical psychology from the University of Texas. He has had a long life interest in Jungian psychology, including the study of dreams, mythology, and comparative religion. Dr. Rob's academic training includes neurophysiology, neurodevelopment, social neuroscience, and multicultural psychology. His clinical experience includes working with individuals, groups, couples, and families, and has worked extensively with children and adults with neurodevelopment and neurodegenerative disorders. On today's episode, we discuss what Jungian coaching model is, how to bridge the gap between Eastern philosophy and Western psychology, and how to live an intentional life being spiritual in the material world. This is a fun episode. It's a little bit heavier than normal, but it is a great listen. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. So one of the things that I was getting, before we get started with the show, is one of the things that I notice as a, you know, yoga teacher, life coach, and I teach like spirituality and mindfulness in yoga studios, that a lot of people in Western cultures really have trouble understanding Eastern philosophy because they try to fit everything into a box. And, you know, Hinduism and Buddhism and Vedantic, Vaishnav, Jainism, they all try to fit them into different categories and different boxes. And they say one thing's classical and one thing's modern. And Eastern philosophy is very fluid. It doesn't really work like that. And I found from my own experience, in order for me to really understand my faith as a Vaishnav, I really had to spend 10 years of unraveling my Western mind to sort of begin to understand Eastern philosophy from a different perspective. Dr. Rob, thank you for joining us on the Living Life on Purpose show. I'm really grateful to have you here. Before we get started, I just want to ask you one quick question to get the conversation going is, sure, as an individual who lives a spiritual life in the Western world, what is your definition of living life on purpose?
Great question. Well, and let me start by saying also thank you for inviting me on your show. It's really an honor. Yes, so living spiritual life on purpose, for me, it's really being aware of what does it mean to be a human being and to be given this incredible gift that we call consciousness, which is, for all intents and purposes, it's a miracle that we are aware of ourselves, of the universe, and that it's just been given freely to us. You know, it's beyond comprehension. Nobody really knows what consciousness is, but it's everywhere, right? And it's the core of our life. And so being aware of that as the central point of your life, that for me is living on purpose.
Thank you, Dr. Rob, for sharing that. And I want to get into Jungian coaching model, but I do have a question I want to follow up with there. And sure. It's a simple question I think that everybody always asks. Why do we struggle with this human condition to find consciousness? I mean, everything around us, all the great religions all tell us to find spirituality, find consciousness. But yet, by and large, most of us focus rather on material pursuits, getting that car, getting that house. And no one ever says you're going to get happy if you just work more hours to get more stuff. Everyone says you'll be happy if you work less hours and spend more time with your family and friends. But yet we seem to always do the opposite of that. And where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I think the way we approach it is that the world appears to us to be a solid experience. We see objects in the world, and it has to do with the way our senses are built. Our senses are designed for survival, and in order to survive in this manifest universe, we need to see objects clearly, and we need to see them as separate from us. But that reality is an apparent reality. It appears that way to us. But we know from both scientific evidence and from ancient wisdom that the senses are not really giving us a true picture of what the universe is. They're giving us a subjective experience of the universe. And for survival purposes, it makes perfect sense because it helps us make moment-to-moment decisions as to what's going on in our immediate environment and what do we need to do to find food, shelter, warmth, all that stuff. But as soon as you start to tease it apart and to really examine what the mind is doing, you see that what we call our reality and what people believe to be very solid and real is simply an apparent reality. It's a type of illusion or mirage. And now we always emphasize it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but the way it exists and the nature of its existence is illusory. It's very much like a dream. The mind creates it in this way, in this fashion, because it's functional, but it's not the absolute reality. And so, you know, if you don't examine it, if nobody teaches you this, you just assume that, well, I'm seeing things and therefore they're real and that's what I'm going to go by. And it kind of makes sense, right? Because it helps you survive and it helps you get by. But we're not really getting at what is the nature of reality. So to get at the nature of reality requires subtle or higher knowledge, meaning you have to use your abstract intellect to peer in through the veil of appearance, and that requires some effort. And you know, that the whole system of yoga, meditation, kind of a philosophical inquiry was really designed for that. And it requires, of course, some focus, some dedication. But the people that are willing to do that, then they're able to perceive past that apparent reality. But, you know, most people, they don't have a chance, right? Because that knowledge is not around them. They're embedded in cultures that are rewarding and emphasizing the material existence of things, right? They're, you know, science is all based on this idea that there is this material, and if we can figure out its molecular structure and its quantum mechanical properties, we'll be fine. And of course, it works to some extent because there are properties, there are laws that are operating at the apparent level. But again, it's not the absolute reality. So the absolute reality requires that kind of drawing back the senses from the apparent reality that we're all experiencing and examining the nature of the mind. Then you get to the nature of a consciousness.
I have two questions. And the first one's going to be the obvious question. What is the nature of reality then?
Yes. The simple answer is it's consciousness. But then the question is, what is consciousness? And exactly. that's where it gets tricky. In defining, let's say, consciousness through language and through our logical linear mind, we always want an object, right? Because if we say, well, it's consciousness, then the mind goes to, okay, let's look for this thing called consciousness and examine it and learn it or something. It's treating it as an object. But the nature of consciousness is that it's not an object. That's why in a lot of wisdom traditions, they say logic cannot get you there. All right, logic gets you to a certain point, but then you have to abandon it because it's not an object. It is the space or the emptiness unto which objects arise, into which you inject thoughts and emotions and abstract concepts. But the substance itself is devoid of name and form, and therefore you cannot use the same logic, the same reason that you use to examine an object, and therefore, you know, I think the Zen and the Taoists come closest to kind of that formulation of the Tao that can be spoken of or that can be identified is not the true Tao, because you've identified it. You've given it a name and a form, and therefore it is not that pure essence of things, the consciousness. Yes.
Now, this is my follow-up question, and this is something I've experienced myself in a couple different modalities until I finally decided to keep going. And I find that people, whether they go to a yoga class or they go to a meditation class or they go to an Eastern philosophy studies class, and I can't speak for what it's like to go into Western Christian mysticism because I've never experienced that. You get into your yoga class and you go there for a little while because, you know, you have back pain, shoulder pain, or you're really stressed at work, and you go there. And you start to practice yoga, and you get to a point in your yoga practice where you're moving really well and you're starting to breathe really well, and you start to kind of want to know what this whole yoga thing's about. And then you start to study it. Mm. And then once it tells you that you're not the body, you're not the mind, you're something spiritual, most people I find go, I don't want anything to do with that. I'm not interested. I'm going to go back to just kind of going to the gym and working out. They go to meditation. because they want to kind of clear their mind. They want to kind of lose some stress. And, you know, business leaders say meditate every day and you'll be, you know, the next Fortune 500 CEO. So high performance people go in and they do like transcendental meditation. They visualize their success. And they get into a point in their meditation where they start to go, okay, this means more. And then they start to study it more. And the Buddha, like the Lama or the, you know, goes, this is not about the material wealth. It's not about the material body. It's about understanding the soul. And they go, I don't want this, and move on. And the same thing goes on with Bhagavad Gita, Kabbalah. Anytime it starts to attack your material consciousness, I find that people just go, I don't want anything to do with that anymore. And we'll go back to my material life, or I'm not happy. But I know that, and I know what that is, and I don't know what this is, so I don't want to go there. Do you experience that?
Oh, absolutely. And we teach our clients that resistance is to be expected. It's part of the nature of the mind to resist the higher knowledge. And, this is why we focus on Jungian psychology as a personal transformation method, which goes really well with the fundamental philosophy of consciousness, because Jung saw it this way. He says, the mind, let's say our conditioned ego mind, will resist change, and it especially will resist that higher knowledge, because that higher knowledge, that higher perspective, dethrones the ego. It's essentially asking the ego to give up its power and its central governing position, and to allow this new information, this new perspective to take hold of the mind. And therefore the ego says, no way. I mean, you know, I'm in control and I've gotten us to survive this far. Why should I give up the power? Why should I give up the control? And so it finds ways to resist that are very clever, right? It's like an internal mechanism that knows our passwords. It knows our history. It knows what scares us. And it'll use all those things to keep us from going there, from realizing this higher potential in us. So the resistance is very powerful, but there are ways to work with it. You know, and that's why essentially we've used the Jungian model, because his whole psychology is about individuation, which means how do we break free of that conditioning that we all experience from early childhood until early adulthood, where we're so busy building up this persona and this idea of ourselves as solid creatures and as physical, social beings. How do we break through that without losing our mind, right? Without kind of going insane, meaning keeping track of the fact that, yes, we need to survive and we need to operate in a social setting, but we also need to transcend ourselves. Because without that, we get stuck in that materialistic perspective of ourselves, which is not satisfying at all. Jung says, if you look at the history of mankind, human beings have always sought a way to transcend their ordinary consciousness, their ordinary awareness, because otherwise you're simply playing out a very limited perspective of yourself, which is the ego perspective. Right? You think you're a small individual in this external universe that appears to be separate from you. And that's not what's happening at all, again, because that's simply the sensory interpretation of reality, the apparent reality. And so it doesn't satisfy us. It feels like we're imposters. I mean, that's why people talk about the imposter syndrome, because they know that they're not really being genuine. They're putting on this mask, this act, and yeah, it's helping them survive, and it's, you know, helping them kind of get along in society, but it's not giving them the experience of the soul, you know, the real experience of self.
The unknown that you can't give any name to.
Yes.
I wanted to take a quick break and remind you that it is never too late to make a choice and decide to make lasting changes in your life and create the life you want and learn to live life on purpose. At Your Wellness Yogi and the Living Life on Purpose community, we are dedicated to helping you discover that spark in life. We offer a variety of life coaching packages that meet your needs and budget. We have group coaching, monthly mindfulness mastermind calls, and one-to-one coaching. Get started today and take advantage of our two free personal one-to-one coaching conversations by taking the Circle Life Quiz, our free life assessment tool that helps you reveal the big picture of your true dreams and paves the road for a real personalized action plan to take control of your life. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/life.
Now, I'm curious then, what is, you know, Jungian coaching and what is that model?
Yes. So Jung, after he studied with Freud for a few years and they collaborated really because they're more equal than kind of teacher student, although Freud, Freud was older. But after he broke with Freud due to disagreements in the theory of psychoanalysis, Jung went through a period of disorientation. But he documented this period in his life, which lasted a couple of years. And through that process that he underwent, he came up with his idea of individuation. Now, a lot of people haven't heard of individuation. They've heard of self-actualization, which is Maslow's theory that came later. But it's the same idea that after you meet certain needs in your life, the survival needs, basic needs, the social needs, there's still other needs to be met. And those higher needs are for transcendence, for spiritual awareness, right? For that experience that people call the soul or a spiritual life. And without that, Jung thought the human is incomplete. Your life will be incomplete and feel incomplete because it is. You're designed for that developmental stage to take hold around, you know, middle adulthood. Wherever that is, it starts to kind of push from within to individuate, to become your true self, beyond your persona, beyond the uniform that you've been wearing as a social creature. And if you don't do that, you will feel stuck. You will feel unsatisfied, dissatisfied, and you know, that's why you see a lot of people kind of tune out with television and shopping and the kind of the material pursuits because they think, well, if I get more of this, more survival stuff, maybe I'll fill that void. But it won't go away until you look inward, right? Until you take that transformative journey inward.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter how you do it, but you have to do it and find a way to get in touch with that soul within. And so he documented this whole process and he called it individuation. So when we looked at the psychologies available out there for us as coaches, that model really stood out for us because here's a model that is talking about personal transformation, but that takes into account much deeper elements of the psyche, spirituality, And he was clearly aware of Eastern philosophy as well. And we can apply it in a non-clinical way. In other words, instead of waiting for people to get neurotic and psychotic and, you know, then showing up at the psychologist's office, we can teach it and propagate it through coaching, through a coaching model, meaning that anybody that wants to, understand their mind and the nature of reality, like we're talking about, can access this information through their own experience. And the psychology then helps us interpret the spiritual transformation in a Western psychological model so that it makes sense to people. Because Jung himself says, you have to apply this process in the context of its time. In other words, you know, it does us no good to just kind of isolate the ancient wisdom and say, okay, we're going to just apply this ancient wisdom in our time out of its cultural context. He says it's got to make sense in what's going on in today's world. So for us, that was a challenge. Can we find a transformation, a real transformation based on a psychological model that we can apply today that makes sense to people in the way we're living now with computers and planes and, you know, the internet and all this stuff. So the coaching model really gave us that combination or the ability to fuse those things. Individuation in a positive coaching model, meaning it's not about healing, it's not about curing any disorder, it's simply about transforming your life so you can fulfill that stage of development that you're meant to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always, whenever I'm working with a client, I'm always like, there's nothing wrong with you. I'm not here to fix you.
Right.
You're not damaged. It's just about figuring out what's going on in your life and then figure out how you can live a more intentional life instead of on autopilot. And I call it the weapons of mass distraction, and you're kind of brushing on it. People are so numbed out because they just don't want to deal with their thoughts, because we live in a world where we have everything we can possibly need. Like, I mean, even if you're, you know, living off of food stamps and you're still living better off than the average person lived 100 years ago. And we don't realize that. And so we wake up in the morning, we turn on the television, so it distracts us from our thoughts. Then we get in the car, we listen to our podcast, we listen to the news, so we don't have to deal with our thoughts. Then we go to work, we come home, we turn on the television because we don't have to deal with our thoughts. And then we have restless night's sleep, so we're tired, so we eat junk because we aren't sleeping, because we're overstimulated and we're unhappy and we're afraid to go inside, which is why so many people, it's like the biggest struggle. I'm always like, when you come home, don't turn on the TV. And people just can't do it. Like, it takes months for them to get up to the ability where they're like, I'll get text messages. I finally came home and didn't turn on the TV. It was really hard for a couple of days, but I was able to get through it. And I took your advice and I drove to work without listening to anything. And I just was able to kind of be with my thoughts and I talked my thoughts out. And my life is so much better. And now I know what to do. And I can't wait to get on the phone with you and talk to you about what I realized.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, those things, they're so difficult for people. So coaching, I think, you know, it's in its infancy right now. But in combination with the technology that we have, the potential is incredible. I mean, we're really excited about what's going on in the coaching world.
I agree. There's a couple of things I want to go over, but there's one of the things I wanted to really hone in on, because it's something that touches to me, and this is why I had you on the podcast, and I didn't want to forget about it, and I don't want to run out of time. Okay. And it is your course on unlocking the power of the Gita. As a Hare Krishna initiated disciple of His Holiness Radhakrishna Swami, the Bhagavad Gita to me is the original self-help book. And I find that the Bhagavad Gita is not really talked about or coached with like Buddhism is in the Eastern philosophy model. All the art of happiness, success, mindfulness, all comes from Buddhism. And we seem to, as Westerners, forgotten about the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. And some of it's the people who are the stewards of the Bhagavad Gita, the Hare Krishna movement, refuses to bring it into a more accessible place for people. Mm. But at the same time, there are other people that have this wisdom that don't really use these tools for coaching. And I love that you have a course on the Bhagavad Gita and how it can help bring success and love and enlightenment into a person's life. And I want to know how you go about teaching the Bhagavad Gita for people living in the modern world without making it new age.
Yes, it is timeless knowledge, and it is, some people define it as the summation of the Upanishads. In other words, all the knowledge of the Upanishads is concentrated in the Bhagavad Gita. And sure enough, if you study it and you look at it, everything is right there. You know, it covers so much. And I think that's part of the problem for Westerners is that because they don't know the context of it, it's hard for them to kind of make sense of what is all this knowledge, you know, talking about, and how do I apply that? But if you take time to study it, to read it, it starts to make sense. And obviously, if you know a little bit of the history and the Upanishads, it makes perfect sense. One of the key principles that we focus on is this idea of living in the world and still living a spiritual life. Because I think up to a certain point, the idea was that you needed to renounce the world if you wanted to live a spiritual life and go off into the forest and meditate. Again, because the sensory world overwhelms the mind, and the apparent reality of things is so powerful that you forget the true nature of consciousness. You start to focus on sensory information. You think, this is what's real. The solid things that I'm able to touch, feel, and hear and experience, that's reality. And that's completely false. The Gita says you're buying into what's called Maya. It's the appearance of the universe, of the manifest universe. It's so powerful that it will just cover up the true reality, the absolute reality. And you will be lost. You will think you are moving in a physical reality when in truth you're constructing it out of your own perception, your own assumptions about what's real, who you are, what's possible, all that. And Maya is so powerful that it reflects everything that you think is there, and it creates it for you. And so you're lost because you think, well, if I'm seeing it and experiencing it, it must be real. But the principle is that Maya will take the shape of what you believe to be true, what you believe is there. And so that kind of traps people in that delusion that the apparent reality kind of consumes them. So that need to renounce the world and go off and meditate, right? That was the basic model for a long time. But in the Gita, then you have this new idea that renunciation is not really leaving the physical world. Again, because the physical world is an appearance. So what does it mean to leave an appearance? It says, and Krishna kind of explains this very patiently to Arjuna, his student, he says, renunciation is in the mind. You can act and take action in the world, but if you renounce the fruit of your action, meaning the result of the action, you're free from it. It's not conditioning you. It's not binding you. In other words, you're not incurring karma by acting in the world. And that is a spiritual breakthrough of, you know, unprecedented dimensions, because what it means that it allows us to live in the world and lead a spiritual existence at the same time through this higher knowledge, through this understanding that if I act in the world without attachment to the results, I'm free. I'm freeing my mind as if I'm sitting meditating in the forest without attachment to, you know, any of the apparent material world. It has the same results. So Krishna says, both paths, sitting in the forest and meditating all your life and acting in the world without attachment to the results, lead to the same place.
Yeah.
So that to us was the key, because that's always the question is, how do I act in this world? You know, how do I do what I need to do, feed my family and be successful and create a business and do the things that I need to do and lead a spiritual life, right? Because if I'm perceiving that those things to be real, I'm caught up. I'm conditioned. In other words, the external then has more power than my mind, and it tells me what my state of mind is going to be. It tells me if I'm going to be happy, if I'm going to feel successful, if I'm going to feel abundant, or if I'm going to feel poor, depressed, miserable, all those things. And I'm giving that power over to this external apparent reality. But that mechanism, that understanding, that higher knowledge that if you act without attachment to the results, you're free from its conditioning power, then you're able to act in a creative way. Because it's not taking action off the table. It's saying you can act. All you're renouncing is the attachment to the results. So a lot of people say, well, wait a minute, doesn't that mean that I won't enjoy the results of my labor? Not at all, because any action will still have an effect, right? Basic physics, cause and effect. You'll be able to actually enjoy it more because you're not attached to it. And the results will be there if you take the action, and you can enjoy it without attachment to it, because attachment just makes you anxious, right? Attachment simply means that you need and expect things to work out in a certain way. And if they don't, you're miserable. And if they do, you're happy. Now that positive and negative, giving it to the external, conditions you. That's conditioning 101 in psychology. If you have a negative response, you know, it's punishment. If you have a positive response, it's a reward. And that conditioning power, then, you're giving over to the environment based on your actions. If you renounce that, meaning if it doesn't mean you don't care, but you're focusing on taking the action instead of getting the results, that power is gone. The environment has no power to condition your mind, and you start to free your mind to where you're able to act from a true decision, a true creative point of consciousness, instead of depending on those external circumstances to make you happy, to give you power, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that is, I think, the central message of the Gita for us Westerners is that we can act in the world. We can do these things. We can have all the things we have and more without being caught up and without those things owning us and conditioning us.
And for those of you listening, I have his Gita course in the show notes. So just open it up and check out his course. And for those of you who are interested in studying the Bhagavad Gita, this is probably a good course to take. And let's continue from here, Dr. Rob, and add on to what you just said. Because I do think all the information you just gave us is something that a lot of people in the Western world struggle with. And they really struggle with trying to have a Eastern philosophy understanding in a Western model of consciousness. And where they struggle is they make it very New Age. And what I mean by that is they'll take a book, they'll take a section of the book that they like, and that's what they'll study. And then the context around the book, they'll discard and say, nope, that's not for me. And at the same time, they don't study the deeper essences of the knowledge that came about the creation of a book. So they'll, you know, like, you know, The Alchemist or, you know, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, they'll read what they like and they'll discard the rest. And I think Westerners really struggle with trying to understand how to fit that into their model of living by applying Eastern philosophy to their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I think the main difference between East and West that I've noticed is that, and I'm trained in Western psychological science. You know, my degree was, my PhD was actually in neurodevelopment. And so I got a pretty good dose of, you know, the scientific method and how we kind of process information about the brain and consciousness in the West. In the West, we always emphasize there's got to be something going on in the mind in order for us to define it as consciousness. In other words, there's got to be a thought, a feeling, an action, something going on. And then we say, okay, that's consciousness, or there's consciousness going on here. In other words, the model is that the brain's 100 billion neurons interacting with each other somehow sparks into existence this thing we call awareness, consciousness, right? That interaction between all these neurons essentially just brings into being this thing called consciousness. In the West, it's completely the opposite. Consciousness exists and predates the formation of the brain, of the nervous system, human beings, human awareness, all that stuff. It is the essence of being and what we call the universe and our awareness. It was already there before we as individuals came into existence. So those two points of view are very different. They're two different paradigms that if you don't understand the difference and you try to interpret Eastern philosophy from the point of view of the Western model, you're going to get a wrong reading, basically. You're not reading it correctly. You know, it's not the same to think about your consciousness coming from the brain and reading Patanjali's meditation instructions. You're going to get a warped interpretation of what he's talking about because the assumptions are very different. You know, if you're assuming that the brain is the production, is producing awareness, consciousness, versus what the author is talking about, that consciousness is the basic fundamental property of the universe and of our mind. Those are two different paradigms. So that's where people go wrong right there, is that they're trying to interpret Eastern philosophy from a Western point of view, from that Western materialistic model. And once you start to accept the basic premise, or at least become aware of it, that what you're reading in Eastern philosophy is essentially coming from that perspective that consciousness is the foundation of the universe, not the material, not the other way around, not that consciousness comes from material, but that material arises in consciousness, then you can get a good reading, right? Then you can get a good interpretation of what are they talking about when they talk about consciousness, dreaming, reincarnation, all those things. You know, the question of reincarnation, often people ask us, you know, are they saying that we're migrating from one physical body to the next? Again, that's a Western interpretation, right? Assuming that our bodies are material and that the soul is kind of jumping from one material body to the next. That's not what reincarnation means at all, right? Because the assumption, again, is that all that we are experiencing, including our physical bodies, are within consciousness. If you accept that and you understand that, then the concept of reincarnation takes on a whole different meaning and a whole different way of seeing it that's truer to the author's intention.
Thank you for sharing that. And we're running out of time. And I want to ask you one final question, and then we'll wrap up, because I'm sure people will love this final question. It's about dreams and your expertise in it. Because a lot of people really want to understand what their dreams are all about. So let's talk about that real quick, just for a few minutes, and then we'll finish up.
Okay. So dreams, you know, our philosophical approach has been this. Can we start with a philosophy that does not require belief, but simply requires observation of our everyday life? And our everyday life is incredible, right? Because if we think about it, we're going through three distinct states of mind in a 24-hour period, which is the waking experience. We're awake. We're receiving sensory information from the world, giving us color, sound, form, and creating this incredible three-dimensional world that we call our waking reality. Then we go into the second state of consciousness, which is dreaming, where our physical body is paralyzed, but our mind is actually more active than in the waking state and generates for us a separate reality, which we call dreaming, where we experience many of the same things that we experience in the waking world, but wholly generated by the internal mind. Now, why would nature force us to do this? Because we're forced to sleep and we're forced to dream, in essence. If we don't dream, we start to get neurotic and dysfunctional. The third state, of course, is that deep sleep where, for the most part, it's dreamless. There's no dreams. We're kind of in a hibernating state. And that's really where we regenerate. We, without that deep sleep, we, you know, our body is not able to repair itself. The immune system starts to break down. All these incredible things start to happen. So those three states, nobody, you know, you don't have to believe in anything because you can observe them in your everyday life, except for deep sleep. But deep sleep, you can kind of deduce that you were in a state of deep sleep, right? When you come out of it, you say, I was kind of out like a log, basically. I didn't experience anything in that period. But the waking world, we can observe, and the dream world, we can definitely observe, especially with some practice. What we started to see was that once we start to pay attention to the dream world, we start to see, as Freud said, the unconscious mind, right? Because it's the royal road to the unconscious. And the dreams that we experience are not simply random, although they appear to be random often. They appear to be random because they're speaking a symbolic language that's very alien and foreign to our conscious mind. Now, Jung believe it's the original language of the psyche that goes back to, you know, the beginning of humankind. This symbolic language, it's encoded, if you don't know, it's like hearing somebody speak a foreign language. It doesn't make sense to you. But as soon as you start to learn its grammar and its symbolism, you can decipher some of the messages that are there encoded in the symbolic form. So as soon as you start to learn this code, this symbolic language, you can start to decipher the messages that the unconscious is giving the conscious mind. And it's also listening to our consciousness. So it starts a two-way communication between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. That two-way communication Jung called the transcendent function. So the transcendent function is the activation of the individuation process. In other words, that connecting of the two elements of the mind, consciousness and unconsciousness, sparks the creation of the self, of the true self. And it is a spontaneous, natural process. It's waiting to take place in every human being. But of course, you have to direct your consciousness inward. If you don't pay attention to your dreams, if you don't try to understand its language and learn the symbolism, it'll always remain disconnected, in a sense, like two people that don't speak each other's language and never bother to learn. There's not going to be a relationship there. But if you do, that relationship becomes the central focus of the transformation that Jung called the individuation process.
Dr. Rob, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Where can everybody find you if they want to work with you?
Yes. The Center of Jungian Positive Psychology. So if you go to the centerofjpp.com, you'll find us. And we're doing coach training. We got an event in Prague coming up soon. And everybody's welcome if they want to come. And we're going to be in Athens at the end of the year as well.
Two nice places to go. Been there. And Dr. Rob, I really do appreciate you guys. We'll have all his information linked up in the show notes, along with his Gita course that I do recommend everyone taking. Any other information that you want to share with us in two quick sentences for our audience so they can kind of begin to live life on purpose?
Yes. You know, the most important thing is to trust in your inner wisdom. In other words, wisdom does not come from books, from others. It's already embedded in us. It is part of our human mind and human consciousness. And if we trust in that, if we learn to trust our own inner wisdom, it'll guide us.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Dr. Robin. Have a great day. I appreciate your time and I appreciate you and all the work you do.
Thank you for listening to the Living Life on Purpose podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes and write us a review. By writing us a review, you will help raise our profile so more people can find us on iTunes. Links to our sponsors and other tools can be found in our show notes, along with other useful information. For more information on our yoga and coaching classes, please visit our website at yourwellnessyogi.com and please sign up for our newsletter. Life is short. Learn to live it on purpose.